We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw one of the checkout stand tabloids proclaiming that William Shatner had become the oldest and fattest man to go into space. And I thought, you know, I really like that take on it. See, I've seen a lot of complaints or commentary by people saying that these new private space flights and so on represent billionaires, yet another case of billionaires hollowing out the public sector. Well, I'll tell you what. It's not as though that isn't a problem in our world. It is. But in this particular case, I think if you look more closely, you see something else entirely. Firstly, you see the beginnings of democratization of space. Sure, it's a very imperfect democratization as of yet, because you've got to have money or else you've got to know somebody. That's not particularly democratic conditions, but it is still better than you have to be on a short list chosen by bureaucrats to become some kind of, you know, national political hero or figure. No. That's not a good situation. That's even worse, right? So it's a less bad situation where if you've got enough money, you can buy your way into space, or if you happen to know somebody, you can argue your way into space. That's, you know, it's the door opening just slightly, but it is opening. You have to remember L5x95. Back in the days of the Apollo landings, people thought, surely there would be 100,000 or 1 million people living permanently off Earth by now. And it just is not the case. Right? It's not. Also, if you want to talk about public sector being hollowed out or what have you, I mean, all you really have to do is look at the shuttle program, which was intended for 50 flights a year and managed 130 flights over 25 years. 30 years, even. 30 years? 30 years almost exactly. So, yeah, managed more like 4 flights a year on average. You've got to look, you know, you've got to look and see, you know, where are things being hollowed out? Well, for one thing, the military-style procurement methods implemented at NASA, you know, the federal acquisition regulations are supposed to assure that the federal government gets the best deal on everything, but in practice have more of a chance of ensuring that the federal government pays 10 times what anyone else would for something. And so it's always pretty easy to find a justification for canceling a program or for realigning the objectives of a program. You know, there are lots and lots of people at NASA either working for the government or working for federal contractors who work for the government, because let's be clear, most of the work at NASA is not done by federal employees. It's done by employees of Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and other contractors, right? Most of those people are in the jobs they're in because they're committed to space. But what happens to them constantly is that they have their priorities realigned. So you get into a project and you're a year or two into a really nifty project, and then Congress decides to cut funding for that and fund something else. And so you've got to stop all the research you were doing and move on to something else. And this helps to explain why not only does NASA not accomplish as much as you'd expect for the amount of money that it gets, but also that it seems to spend a lot of time doing the same things over and over, redoing things. Because, after all, you've got to start from scratch again and again and again. Do you know how many different systems, for instance, were proposed as replacements for the shuttle, and substantial sums of money were plowed into them, but no actual flying vehicles were ever built? It happened repeatedly. And, of course, this has the characteristic that, well, the aerospace contractors, right, the companies that sell to the government, they get pretty much all the money but never have to deliver a working product, which is a pretty good business model, isn't it? It's demoralizing to your engineers and technical people who want to build things that fly in space. And that's what SpaceX, Blue Origin, and so on are offering to the people who work for them, the chance to actually see stuff happen. And equally, that's what we have to offer if we want to build a non-governmental, non-capitalistic space program. Because I guarantee you, right, this is something I've been thinking about for a long time, as is not a secret at all. I guarantee you there are lots of people who want to see something happen in space and would be willing to work for it, would be willing to help pay for it. That's what we need to harness. And, to be perfectly frank, the more this space tourism, the more this apparent frivolity happens, the better the chance that we can do that. So, I really do believe a lot of the criticism is misplaced. Another angle on this. You may remember the DCX, which demonstrated, you know, a large vehicle landing using rocket thrust back in the 1990s. What you may not realize is that the money that was used for that from the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, not from NASA or the Air Force, BMDO also funded the Clementine lunar probe at that same time, which was the first U.S. moon mission in 20 years plus. BMDO was handing out grants for paper studies on advanced launch systems. One of them happened to go to a group that included G. Harry Stein, the godfather of model rocketry. Well, Stein said, never mind the paper study. I have an RL-10 rocket engine in my garage, which has had the nozzle cut down so it'll work in atmosphere. Not everybody could say that, but certainly G. Harry Stein could. He was quite the guy. You know, when he died, that was a great loss for the world. But that's not the point. The point is, they built a working vertical landing rocket vehicle using liquid hydrogen fuel, which is kind of difficult to work with. They built all that for what was supposed to be the cost of a paper study. Everyone was flabbergasted. They did these amazing technology demonstrations. No one could believe they were doing it. The project then got handed over to NASA. NASA did a couple of flights with it, and then it cracked up on landing. I'm not attributing that to malice or even incompetence. It's just one of those things which is bound to happen. And then the money for the DCXA, which is the follow-on program, got diverted to do what? A paper study. In particular, a paper study of big, dumb boosters. Bigger, expendable launch vehicles, exactly the sort of thing that the DCX program would make obsolete. But that wasn't important because somebody in Congress thought it was more important to fund this study of big, dumb boosters than to fund actual work on actual space launch systems. So that kind of thing just keeps happening. Now, I've actually got a little book here to try and keep me... I try to be consistent about writing down my show ideas in this little booklet that I have, notebook. I don't know how good I'm going to be about that, but thought I would mention I just had two more films transferred. They're on their way back now. Quite a pretty penny to have that done. As I've mentioned before, it tends to cost $10 to $15 a minute to transfer 16mm film. And my backlog of atomic energy films for transfer is only growing. I've bought four reels in the past couple of weeks. One of them, well, two of them are classroom instructional films from the U.S., English language, which is nice, about radiation and radiation measurements. One of them is an instructional film with, I guess, actors playing people like Pierre and Marie Curie and Henri Becquerel. Anyway, produced, I think, a German-Italian co-production. Anyway, and the fourth one, I'm not really sure what it is. I won't know until I get it. The seller thought that it might be a documentary about French nuclear testing in the South Pacific. We'll see when it gets here. And there are several more I have my eye on because I found a guy in Paris who has a number of nuclear energy films for sale, of course, pretty much all in French language according to his listings. But one of them is an animated film about the two isotopes of uranium. I have another animated film called Fuel for the Future, which is in the British Film Index, but BFI, British Film Institute, doesn't have a copy. I've got a copy, and I'm going to get it transferred. I just haven't done it yet. That's probably going to be the next thing that goes out after this order comes in. Anyway, so if you're one of the generous people who sent me some money to assist my efforts, I figured you might like that status update. Now, what else? Well, we've had a G20 summit. We're having the 26th Conference of Parties to the Rio de Janeiro Climate Accords, and it seems like nothing very useful is being accomplished. The Chinese, only a few weeks ago, were making promises to not invest in more coal projects, and now they've backed away from that. Why? Well, because there are power shortages in China. They need fuel. You've got to keep the lights on, right? You've got to maintain a certain level of economic activity or you begin to have civil unrest. And what that means in practice is whatever it is, no matter how awful it is, and coal, particularly under Chinese conditions, is pretty awful, that's going to happen in preference to any of these ideas about how we're all going to reduce our energy usage, which people keep telling me, well, you just got to reduce your energy usage. There are very strong social pressures against that, because when you reduce the energy usage, in general, life gets worse. People don't like that. Well, again, seems like an elementary point to me, but you can see this, as a matter of fact, in the way the U.S. government is talking out both sides of its mouth, right? At the G20 summit, at COP21, U.S. government has been pressing for more and more restrictions on carbon emissions, while at the very same time, trying to put diplomatic pressure on OPEC to increase oil production. Because economic recovery from the pandemic demands more energy. And if that energy is coming from burning fossil fuels, the United Nations Environmental Program, which manages things like COP26, remains unremittingly and implacably hostile to nuclear energy. They simply will not accept it as an option. And why? The only reason I can give you is that it seems too easy. Because when you invest in nuclear energy, then you don't have to say, well, we can either have a level of energy usage that's consistent with our social progress goals, or we can have good environmental outcomes. Nuclear allows you to do both. And there are people who don't trust that. I'm sorry to say, Alvin Weinberg, one of the fathers of nuclear power, has to be considered at least partly responsible for this because of his use of the phrase Faustian bargain. Now, what he meant by it and what people took him to mean, are probably two different things. He tried to clarify later on what he actually meant, as opposed to what he was taken to mean, that he didn't really mean that nuclear energy was of the devil or something like that. But he used that phrase, Faustian bargain, and people continue to feel as though this solution is too easy, it must be a deceit of the devil. That's the only way I can describe it, a deceit of the devil. Because how can you possibly have it both ways? How can you possibly both have an acceptable level of economic output to assure the kind of prosperity that's needed for social goals and also have positive environmental outcomes? Now, do I believe that you can? Well, I think you can look, for example, at France and Germany, compare them, realize that French emissions are half those of Germany. And the only real difference between the two countries economically is where they get their electricity. Not to mention, French electricity prices are half those of Germany. Now, again, energy stringency is breaking out all over. In the United States, oil and gas prices are higher. We're not seeing a lot of extra drilling. Instead, what we're seeing is share buybacks and larger dividends. Why? Well, the whole fracking era, which is now, you know, we're now 12, almost 15 years into the hydrofracking boom. Well, for investors in oil and gas industries, it's been more of a bust. That these are extractive industries which require very large capital investments, and the payoffs that they've been seeing have been much smaller than what they put in. In other words, investors have been losing money, and so they want higher oil and gas prices. It doesn't make sense to drill these kinds of wells, right, to produce oil and gas under these conditions, except at significantly higher prices. Well, the implication is, you know, people say, well, you know, what are the reasons that fossil fuels are so successful in compared to nuclear is the higher capital costs of nuclear. Well, maybe that's a misconception because we're not looking in the right places where the costs are. What else have we seen happening? Well, you know, I saw a headline which said, Al Gore-backed study finds that climate emissions are undercounted. Well, I would not trust Albert Gore Jr. further than I could throw him, because for all that he talks about climate, he has never voiced a single word of regret over killing the Integral Fast Reactor program, which was the U.S. program for developing sustainable nuclear energy, which would not only recycle the plutonium from spent nuclear fuel that's been accumulating over 60 years in the United States, but would also provide a way of disposing of plutonium from surplus nuclear weapons, which we are, by the way, legally obligated to do under an agreement with Russia, and over more than 20 years, that's never actually been done. The U.S. government has spent billions of dollars, and I know I harp on this, billions of dollars developing alternative disposition strategies which are not actually allowed by the agreement we have with Russia because of a political unwillingness to address plutonium as a civil reactor fuel. But skipping over that, do I think it likely that climate change emissions are being undercounted? Well, yes. Firstly, by their very nature, they're difficult to count, right? Difficult to survey, difficult to examine, difficult to get a good handle on. Sure, you can calculate what's coming from big coal-fired power stations. That's pretty easy. Fugitive methane emissions from leaky gas lines, that's a lot harder. Methane emissions from German biogas plants, that's difficult. Carbon dioxide and methane from different agricultural practices, that's difficult. Now, one more reason why COP26 hasn't accomplished much of anything, won't accomplish much of anything, right? One more reason why these activities continue to accomplish very little has to do with vested interest in what I have to call climate scams. In other words, you know, to give you an example, nice piece in the Wall Street Journal last week sometime about a big private equity fund buying up a tract of what was described as forest land, although I guess it might just as easily have been tree plantations, monoculture tree plantations. Great stuff, right? Really promotes biodiversity, really promotes wildlife habitat, etc. Yeah. And why were they buying it up? Well, to sell carbon offsets, obviously. To a great extent, from the small scale of these carbon offsets people are urging you to buy whenever you buy, like an airline ticket, all the way up to these cap-and-trade systems, which provide yet another way for big money players in the market to scrape off value from the top of the economy, there's just a lot of climate scams. And I think that this fact, that there's a lot of these things that are obviously scams, is one of the things which drives people to the position of political climate denialism, right? There are people who simply don't believe that climate change is actually happening because, and that it's, you know, has human contributions, precisely because the people who talk most loudly about climate change and about how we need to do, urgently need to do big things in order to stop it, are always promoting what are obviously ineffective measures, and they're always resistant to what would be effective measures. They're always to be found on the side of these cap-and-trade schemes, on the side of carbon offsets, on the side of, I mean, you talk about renewable energy investments. Who has made big renewable energy investments? Well, Germany certainly has. German emissions haven't fallen at all since 1998, according to official figures, which are probably a bit optimistic. Right? So, these people reason, and it's not the worst reasoning I've ever heard. Why should I believe that this is real if the people who say it's so important don't seem to believe it's real and are just using it as a money-making opportunity? Another thing that we have to bring in here is that carbon dioxide emissions are not the whole story, not by a very long shot. You know, you've got things where people are saying, we're seeing the effects of climate change now, but most of the stuff they're talking about is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily the result of other bad practices. Big wildfires in the American Far West are a great example here. We've gotten very good at suppressing small to medium-sized fires. But if you suppress small to medium-sized fires, you've got to do something which is called prescribed burning, where you go through and you deliberately set fires to burn certain areas over so that you get rid of the fuels which will otherwise cause really big fires that you can't suppress to break out. Well, in the Far West, there have not been nearly as many of these prescribed burns as there should be. Why? Well, it's a combination of factors. California is a great example. If you want to do a prescribed burn, obviously you have to do it in such a way that it doesn't destroy, for example, people's houses. People get really mad at you when you do that, right? So you have to have a plan, and your plan is going to be very dependent on weather conditions, rain, wind, etc. So you have to have a plan, and then you can wait all year waiting for the right circumstances to come around. Of course, these plans become more and more difficult to formulate as people move into places where there previously weren't a lot of people, right? It's much more difficult to protect many houses scattered all over the place than a few houses clustered together. So bad forestry practices contribute significantly to these megafires. Another problem, in California particularly, you've got to have permits of every kind. Do you suppose the California Air Resources Board wants to issue permits for a big fire? No! The idea horrifies them, right? So it can be really difficult to arrange these prescribed burns. Well, what I'm saying is the effects of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are mostly on quite long time constants. If we stopped all emissions today, we would still be seeing the effects in 300 years. This is the thin end of the wedge, right? We are just seeing the beginnings of the effects of the accumulation of carbon dioxide, you know, which is, you know, double pre-industrial concentrations, right? We're just beginning to see these effects. If we don't correct these bad practices now, what we think is going to happen is going to be a lot worse. On the other hand, if we do correct these bad practices now, a lot of the bad effects that people have been predicting will be significantly mitigated. I know I talk about the South Asian brown cloud a lot, but it's another good example. The South Asian brown cloud is, you've got to call it global climate change. It's affecting atmospheric circulation patterns on a global scale. You're not getting as much moisture evaporating from the equatorial Indian and Western Pacific Oceans because of this fug caused by two-stroke engines from Kenya to Indonesia, also caused by a lot of other factors, burning of coal in India for power, all these kinds of things. We've got to clean this up. Because water vapor has extremely complicated effects. Because, yes, on the one hand, water vapor is a very powerful greenhouse gas. On the other hand, clouds increase the albedo of the Earth, causing more heat to be reflected into space instead of absorbed on Earth. And, furthermore, water, when it's evaporated, takes up heat. When it rains out, it releases that heat. So water transports heat from one part of the world to another, one part of the globe to another. So if we're suppressing evaporation in the equatorial Indian and Pacific Oceans with this South Asian brown cloud, it has a lot of effects on global atmospheric circulation patterns. And some of those are sure to aggravate what people are thinking of as the effects of climate change caused by carbon dioxide. Well, this is climate change caused by something else entirely, right? You're going to see, well, you already are seeing, droughts in Australia and South America, things like this, disturbances of weather and ocean circulation patterns. If we can clean up the use of energy in East Africa and South Asia, we can reduce these harms substantially, which means we have a lot more breathing room for dealing with the effects of carbon dioxide, which are mostly happening much further down the road. But, you know, what else is there to say, other than to mention that Elon Musk was really baffled the other day because Tesla stock went through the roof on the announcement that Hertz Rent-A-Car was going to buy 100,000 Tesla cars. He tweeted, it's nice that the market capitalization has gone up to it, market valuation is now $1 trillion, but we're already selling the cars as fast as we can make them. It doesn't really matter who orders how many. So I thought that was a fun moment of self-awareness from someone not otherwise usually known for it. But in 10 seconds is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And thank you.